U.S. Go. Surgeon.
Go.
Booster.
Go.
Copy that. We have a go from you guys.
Sound. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Talking Sound Podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host, coming to you live from Austin, Texas. The Talking Sound Podcast is now officially brought to you by PodcastCadet.com. If you're a fan of podcasting like I am, love podcasts, want to make a podcast for yourself, business, friends, family, school, church, whatever, stop on by PodcastCadet.com today. That is all that we do over there. One-on-one consultation is what we provide. It is straight up professionals in the industry, everything from branding your show, naming your show, where to host, how to host, distribution, monetization, every question from how do I set up my equipment to how do I get my stuff on iHeartRadio. We have answers for you. Stop on by today. Talking Sound 20 is the code that you want to use. PodcastCadet.com is the website. Our guest today, the amazing Chris Sudol, coming to us from the UK. How are you doing today, Chris?
Hey, I'm good, Chris. Two Chrises online.
That's right. I have been working with you for many years now. You're an audio engineer by trade, but really jack of all trades when it comes down to production, live production.
Yeah, jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah. And it's been really interesting to work with you over the last few years and kind of get to know you off of site a little bit and get into some of the... and really get into some of the interesting history that you have in the industry. What was it that first brought you to the world of audio engineering, Chris?
The world of audio engineering, it goes back into the 70s, believe it or not. Yeah, I'm 50 years old shortly. On the next 4 weeks, I'll be 50. So when I was a young boy, I had a real passion for electronics, even down to, I think I got my first soldering set when I was about 4 years old. And I used to love playing with electronics and building things. So I come from an engineering background where my father was the chief inspector for Rolls-Royce. My grandfather was the apprentice instructor for Rolls-Royce. So the whole mechanical logic was inbred into me. Anyway, a friend of my father, when I was 7 years old, gave me a set of speakers. And being intrigued with what they did, I had to take them apart, as you do when you're that age. And so I rebuilt them and then started putting other things together. And then when I was 9 years old, I built everything to do the school disco. So I didn't use vinyl, I used cassette machines, and I'd worked out how I could mix the two. And I built the first mixer using a crossfade. From components that one of my other uncles gave, because he was a sales rep for an electronics company over in England. And one thing led to another. So we're doing the school disco. And then when I got to about 14 years old, I'd hit the height of about 6 feet. So I was going out drinking, as you do, at 14 years old. Don't tell my mother. Don't tell. So
our secret, Chris.
Absolutely. And I was watching rock bands, as you do at 14. I had a real keen interest in music. So when you're watching bands, and then I remember watching a band and his guitar amp, I think it was an old model, possibly a Vox AC30, it went down. So I said, hey, I can probably repair that for you. Anyway, I took it away and worked out that one of the valves had gone. Real simple fix for me. And then I became sort of known locally as the man that could fix instruments. And so I was setting up guitars, balancing valves on amplifiers, generally sorting things out for people at 14, you know, at 14, yeah. 15 years old, going to school late with a hangover, getting in trouble at school. And that sort of introduced me into the industry of music.
And, you know... So much of my story is reflected in that, as far as the tinkering with electronics, playing around with it. Even my 3-year-old is fascinated with it. I've had a rack of decommissioned gear that has been his since he was able to walk. Like, if you're going to touch knobs, feel free to touch them on this cabinet over here. He's very clear about which ones he's able to touch, which ones he isn't. And to encourage that in a child, like you were saying, to have a dad who worked for Rolls-Royce, grandfather who did the same thing, worked in engineering, it was of course something that when they saw your inclination, as you said, even at 4 years old, they purchased you a soldering iron, and you started learning tools of the trade at that point.
That's right. And I used to go around old secondhand stores and just looking for old broken equipment, and I'd buy things that were in the scrap bin, you know, just old record players that didn't work, and sometimes they were irreparable, but I'd remove the components, transformers, and then I'd find things that, you know, I could repair, and that's how I made my money. I was selling things at school, saying, hey, I've got this for sale.
Yeah.
And started to make some money out of it as well, which is, and you start to learn more about electronics. So yep. It's pretty much sport, really.
Yeah, I mean, I got in trouble all the time with my mom for taking things apart and not being able to put them back together right. You know, it was like, the least you could do is put my hair dryer back. Cool that you find out how it works, but I got to get ready for work on Monday morning, and now I don't have a hair dryer. Because you took it apart and couldn't get it back together.
I know. I remember in small sports when I was younger, because with the electronics things I could make, and I remember at school, one of the handles on the doors were metal then, and I'd made a very high voltage, low current through the door handle. So when the teacher opened the door, he got one hell of a shock.
Yeah.
I mean, I got into trouble for that, but you know, these are the things I was doing. I was creating things, and I think in 1984 I'd sort of first internet as well, of transferring data from what I think it was a ZX81, Sinclair ZX81 I think I had at the time, and a friend of mine had one, and we were using radio frequencies to transmit data across. So it was, hey, can you send me a program? And I think that was sort of the first internet, really. I should have marketed that.
Yeah,
gone somewhere.
And you know, that is a frequent thing done by high-end ham users and stuff, is to literally bounce data off the moon and satellites and trade images and programs, things like that. It was very much the rudiments of the internet as we know it today. And to know that you were playing around with that when you were a teenager. Go ahead.
I mean, if you remember, all your data was stored onto cassette tapes.
Yeah,
and so it was very easy to transmit across radio waves, providing that you had a constant signal.
Yeah,
and you know, with making amplifiers and things that we did, we got I'd say probably about 90%. It was 90% continuity.
Wow.
If it didn't work, then you try it again, and it was fun. You know, then you get people on the radio bands hearing all this so-called digital noise, wondering what it was.
Now, at what point did your tinkering take the professional turn? Like you said, you kind of became one of the go-to people in the local scene for fixing instruments, amplifiers, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But at what point did you realize that this was really something that you could be doing.
It was at 16, and I was working as a roadie for a quite a successful local band, which had got a small record deal, and they'd been given an advance, and the songwriter and he was an exceptional songwriter, a very good producer. Unfortunately, he died now. And so with the advance from the record company, he invested it into a recording studio. Now, the recording studio had to be built. So I said, hey, look, I can do this for you. You know, so I made up all the looms, made up all the patch bays, literally made every cable and soldered up every XLR. And I was 16. I'd be up till 4 o'clock in the morning. So that progressed to understanding then that I've got this mixing desk to play with, which in the day was a Bell Modular, and we had a 16-track 2-inch tape machine. So as I'd installed everything, it progressed and I'd start to learn of production. So while we were recording, I was the number two in the studio, and it progressed into that I realized then I had a set of ears and I could mix bands in the studio. And if I could mix a band in a studio, then to take that live was the next progression.
Yeah.
Obviously, when you do it live, you can't press stop and rewind and then go back again. So you're in the hot seat. So I started in London, doing some shows in London at, I think it was an old club called Dingwalls in Camden Town. And then it progressed then. I was mixing more bands. And then my first big tour was the Hollies.
Now, wow.
Which at the time, which was Graham Nash wasn't in the Hollies anymore. He left in, I think, 71. But it was pretty much still the original lineup. So that was the start of my career, really, into the professional industry. Then with working with everybody that I've worked with, you know, being system tech for Dave Matthews' band when he toured the UK twice, which was a real big achievement, you know, in my career.
Yeah.
And many other bands in the 70s, you know, some of the British bands like Slade, Deep Purple. I think it's when I pull my tour passes out that I realise all the people I have actually worked with.
Yeah, because it does really kind of, over the years, just kind of run together. I didn't do as much tour work. Most of mine was in-house, but even to go through and look at the reams of shirts and things like that that I have from bands that went on to make it, that I mixed, it's one of those, like, wow, when you've spent that long doing something, it really does begin to span moments of your life. Like you said, to work with people like Deep Purple, Dave Matthews Band.
Yeah. And I think with the diversity within the industry, and I think, you know, for your listeners that are sort of getting into this industry, I would sort of look at different ways of engineering. Now, I was very, very, you know, I was a studio engineer. I was a rock and roll engineer. I was a business engineer. Also, I worked a lot in theatre, and I worked a lot in the corporate industry. So, audio engineer to go to rock and roll, theatre, or corporate, we're all equal. Now, the industry today, you get a rock and roll engineer, and you try and put him in theatre or her in theatre.
Yeah.
Then it's a totally different game, if you will. Same with corporate.
Mm-hmm.
That world. So I was lucky that I'd worked in all those industries or different disciplines, if you will, through my whole engineering career, which then progressed me to the level as to where I am now within production.
Yeah, I can definitely say that my experience of working in theater to begin with and moving off into rock and roll, doing broadcast video, all those things have kind of culminated into where my path is now, which is full circle back to the Utterly Live. We're doing it once. We get one chance to get it right, guys. Noises off. Let's get it done. And it really is different, because when you work live rock and roll, especially shows that are moving from location to location, things are going to happen. There's going to be issues that are beyond your control, even though it's your system, you know, and you just kind of roll with those punches and you make it happen. And typically the tech is, we're the only ones that are aware 90% of the time that is the case, unless it's like half the sound system that goes off.
that has happened to me in previous years. I mean, I think when you look at as being an audio engineer, I always say the best place to start for anybody that wants to get in the industry is start to mix a rock and roll band in a bar.
Yeah.
That you're against difficult acoustics every evening and different acoustics. And also the level of the back line can be loud, and you have to you have to use extra skills to create this audio, to create this mix.
Yeah.
So we go back to the 80s where audio systems were all points and source. There was no line array. We didn't have plugins.
Yep.
You know, you were lucky if you had compressors and noise gates, and you may just have one reverb.
Well, it was really to the point where it was true PA. It was public address systems, and it was sound reinforcement. It was not, let's have a line array in a venue. It was, we've got some speakers so that people can hear what we're saying over all these instruments.
And as an engineer, I'd work with a drummer and say, hey, come on, let's tune this kit so it may sound great in your garage, but in a live environment, I'd work with the musicians to get the best sound.
Yeah.
So if you want all the source sounding great, all you need to do then is amplify it. Where I look at the industry now, a lot of years, I've come across this so many times as being a systems engineer, and I was very fortunate to work with a company in the United Kingdom called Adlib Audio. It's one of the biggest companies in the UK for audio rental.
Mm.
So I was one of their senior systems guys, and watching a lot of engineers coming in, and all they were interested in is what plugins they could run. And I'd listen to things, and it was so compressed.
Yeah.
Everything was very digital, and there was no light and shade to the mixes. And I sort of started to fall out with the industry then, because I was putting so much time into designing the systems for the arenas and the stadiums, and then listening to what's coming out and think, and the engineers are spending more time looking at what the processing is, what the plugins are, what they can laptop. And to me, I started to lose my passion for being an engineer. Now, so I've probably got one last tour in me, and I don't know who that's going to be, but I think many people ask me who would I ever tour with if I had the chance? And there's a million people out there.
Yeah.
Fantastic. If I could do one more tour that I'd really want to do, and as a British engineer, you'd expect me to come out with something like Paul McCartney or, no, it would be the Dixie Chicks.
Wow. Wow.
That would be the tour of my dream tour. My last final tour.
There is some incredible precision of engineering that goes on with that style of music and that level of production with music.
Absolutely. Yeah. When I listen to the production, when I listen to their albums, and I, you know, take the production away and look at the source and the
exactly
conditions there. You know, the quality of the writing, the light and shade. It's to engineer that you'd be almost enhancing the solos and working as an engineer, as a musician, and that's where I feel an engineer needs to be.
Yeah.
You need to be part of that environment that's coming at you.
Well, and it's interesting that you bring that up, because so frequently we have forgotten the fact that, yes, back in the days of the original Abbey Road studios, things like that, the engineers were literally that. They were not musicians. They were not people who had like an idea how to play the guitar. They were literally white coat engineers who knew acoustics and knew how to properly capture a sound. And that was it. They knew how to move those knobs in there and warm up the tubes just right to make that microphone pick things up right in that room.
That's a great comment. It's something I'd forgotten about. When I was in the studio back in 1986, and we used to have a great British Spring as the reverb. Now, I don't know if you remember those.
Yeah.
But it was pipe. Probably about 6 feet long with six springs in there. And you could dampen the speaker on one end and a microphone on the other.
Yeah.
So the speaker would, the springs reverberate, and you would control the reverberation by pressure on the spring. The microphone would pick that up, like it is on a Fender Twin Reverb.
Exactly.
Pretty much the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's how reverb. So in the drum booth that we had, which was an old coal shed, and I converted it into a drum booth, so I padded the walls out. And then I had a friend of mine, He was a sheet metal worker. So I said, can you get me a piece of sheet metal, 6 foot by 6 foot? So he said, yeah, okay, why? I said, if you can just get me this piece of sheet metal. And I found this piece of sheet metal on the wall in the drum room. And then I went to, I bought a little PZM microphone and then put the PZM microphone into the middle. That was a plate reverb.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And it's just the idea of making whatever you need happen in order to capture the sound in the environment. And that's truly taking it right back to what engineering actually is. Is to accentuate what's already there. Like you said, to work with that level of talent, guaranteed, like hanging out at 9, 10 a.m., those women sound that way in the tour bus. Much less behind a PA or in a studio. Because they are talented musicians. And it's a different thing whenever you start working with that. One of my favorite bands in the world, as you know, is Rush. And it was probably about 2-3 tours ago, the first round of the Clockwork Angels tour, I went and saw them in Houston with my brother and had already worked the show. And could literally hear the engineer dialing out preset delays and things like that that were obviously there from the album, you know, like stem track kind of.
Yeah.
Because that's the reverb and delay that they used on the album, but it was not working in the room. And you could hear him changing that mix live in the room if you were an engineer and knew it was happening.
Yep. The delays would work in the studio.
Yeah.
And a band that I worked with for many, many years was The Suite. And unfortunately, very sadly, Steve Priest, the bass player, died last week.
Oh, wow.
So there's one remaining member of Suite left now, which is Andy Scott, the guitarist. But when I was mixing them live, and I had to use a lot of the delays because in the original mixes from the 70s, there was loads of delay in the production on the vocal.
Yeah.
So trying to reproduce that live in those days, we didn't have a tap delay. So, you know, the band would have to make sure that their tempo was correct because I'd have the delays programmed into an old, I think at the time it was an SPX 92 or something where I was programming the delays into that. I'd have them all set as different memories, 250 milliseconds, 400 milliseconds, 600 milliseconds, and recall them. And if the tempo was incorrect with the band, my delay time would be wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, again, was, you know, working together and producing live what was created in the studio and working together as not just, you know, oh, that's the engineer, he's just an engineer. It was working as a whole group of people. Yeah. Same with the backline guys, you know, making sure that, you know, say the backline guys, you know, hey, I want these amps just facing upwards so it doesn't bleed into the front row.
Yep.
There's so many parameters of mixing live that I think a lot of people don't see that anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's always been, because I myself still work in the analog realm in my home studio for all of my music production. I am still to this day an analog fiend. I wish that we used analog more in the big rooms that we do in corporate, because I have seen digital boards lock up in the middle of a show. And it's like, we're dead in the water till that thing reboots. You can't just patch by on a channel. Like at least with analog, you know, there was always some way to hardline bypass something in the system.
Well, into my career now, as you know, because we've worked together for many years. Mm. For your listeners, they don't know what my career is now, which I suppose we can come on to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe you want to tell a little bit of people about my transition, and then we can sort of skip back as to how I look at audio.
Well, let's do that. Go ahead, because, of course, as most of my audience knows, I myself have moved on from rock and roll and mainly work in the corporate AV field, touring the country, things like that. That is where I ran across Chris Sudol. And he literally, I traveled the country. He travels the world to see this guy's app on his phone that maps his airline travel is like watching 18 Indiana Jones intros in a row. It's just pinging back and forth between countries. It's crazy. So let's get into a little bit about what brought you from this world of live rock and roll and doing that into the world of high-end AV production and traveling the world doing that.
What brought me to, I'd always worked, I think when we were discussing earlier, as an engineer working rock and roll theater and corporate, and I always enjoyed the corporate world. Now, you know, some people really hate it because it's really boring listening to presentations all day long. But the corporate world, I really enjoy. And for me, I'm very much a client-based person. I love working with the clients. So yeah. Corporate world, I was steering more into doing that as an engineer into the corporate world. For a start, the money was so much better. I was getting to live on rock and roll tour buses, moving from venue to venue. So I was opting to do more and more corporate. Now, the more corporate that I was working, and because of my age and working in rock and roll and sometimes being tour manager, production manager, the natural progression to become a project manager, production manager, technical director, it took a natural role for me.
Yeah.
When I was working on events, I'm a little bit older than most people, so the client would start speaking to me, and it was becoming that I was being taken away from my own job as being an audio engineer to deal with the request of the client. Then the client was saying, hey, look, this client asked for you. We're not going to put you as an audio engineer. Could you be the project manager? Absolutely. And it progressed to lots of, you know, bigger and bigger and bigger, and to mm-hmm. some of the events that we've worked on together in the States.
Yeah.
And we've had some pretty big conferences, you know, multi-million dollar conferences.
Yeah.
And that's what I do worldwide now. So we will have conferences with sometimes tens of thousands of people there. It's very, very challenging for me. And, you know, a lot of sleepless nights and a lot of long days. You guys are sort of working on a, you know, 8 to 10 hour day. And then I try and break you guys at that time. And then I'm still working till 1, 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
Writing the clothes for the next day, coming in with a happy smiley face. And dealing with so much. Now, as you've seen, I can get a little bit stressed when things are going sometimes not how I want them.
Sure.
Sometimes doing things how I do, and I look at them where my problem solving, and this goes back to my own, where with audio, I solve an audio problem before it happens. I'm really an interest in video and video production. I know what I want to see. So where I don't use my ears anymore to mix bands or produce bands, because I've sort of lost my passion for that. Mm. I've really got a passion now for looking at events and looking at the visual of what I see and talking to the clients and working between myself and the client and coming up with a great production.
Yeah.
And obviously audio, big point of that, because I want the audio perfect, but I try not to get involved in the audio. I let the audio guys deal with that.
Yeah.
Some of the audio guys are a little bit nervous around me because they know my history. But, you know, once they know me, they know that I don't really care as long as it's done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's the fact of you wouldn't have us on the show if you didn't trust our skill set to begin with.
Absolutely.
You know, there is that inherent trust that happens between a production crew and a producer eventually, where it's like, you know, the reason I'm having you guys here is because I know I don't have to worry about video. I can just deal with the client, you know.
Yeah.
Things like that. And it does take a very most of the reason I switched over to corporate was because I found that it was a much harder flex of my muscle every day mentally. The level of precision that was necessary, to get the job done properly was higher. So it kind of made my level of expectation for myself higher and what I could do and how I did it. And yeah, it really is a different level of expectation and a different level of production once you get into it. And it can be very addictive for those of us that really the only way to say it is get off on that end of the industry. Because not everybody does, you know.
When I have a great team there, you know, when I've got guys like yourself, and then there's some great engineers, you know, one with mind is DJ Lance. I've got some great guys, Brian Nesbitt. You know, I throw all these guys into the pool. I can really do my job then. I don't have to worry about the production because I know that you guys have got everything sorted for me. And if there is a technical problem, which does happen, I know now that I don't really have to go and worry too much. That I know that you guys have sorted it. And if there is a problem, it's shown to the clients, I can go to the client and say, yeah, there's a technical hitch, but, you know, the guy sorted it.
Yeah.
You know, how many times do we turn a laptop on and try and print, and the printer doesn't work? You know, I'm sure that, you know, everybody in the world that this happens to, and this is what happens with technology.
Yeah.
And then it gives me to explain to the clients, and everybody's happy.
Yeah, yeah. It really is a lot of client handling, a lot of things that you typically don't have to deal with whenever you're a touring audio engineer. You're maybe dealing with 5-6 people at a time, depending on the band, you know, and maybe a house manager, something like that. But once you start dealing with the production end of things and being a tour manager and start working into that end of it, it really does change your perspective and it changes the way that you look at things. Like I said, it made it to where, instead of going to work and just getting through work, I viewed every day as a challenge, you know, and it really does up your game a lot. And with that in mind, how has that changed your perspective on engineering, Chris?
I don't know really. I think my whole perspective on, especially in my life, has changed substantially because I'm doing what I do now. And when I look at, you know, the touring, I don't miss it. It's very difficult. I'm so comfortable in what I'm doing now
as
a big technical director. I don't really spend much time looking at what other people are doing within the rock and roll world. And certainly at this moment now, where the things are now with the worldwide pandemic, I see major changes in the whole industry, from the music industry, the corporate industry, the video industry. And general work, I think, you know, we still really don't know what's going to happen, but I certainly know within our industry there's going to be some huge changes.
There's going to be massive changes.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these changes are not going to be for the good, you know, for the people that go out there and, you know, and earn a buck, you know, like we do.
Mm.
So I think we need to rediversify. We need to start looking at our skill sets and using transferable skills. There's so many engineers, technicians out of work at the moment, myself included. I'm looking at different things now, and I think with what I've worked with in the United States, which is a fantastic place, you know my passion for the, you know, for being in the United States. I love the country. You know, it's I would happily live there, and I will not have anybody say a bad word about the country.
You love it more than many Americans I know. Most Americans, yeah. I know. Most I know would be willing to expatriate tomorrow given the chance. You are like, where's my ticket?
I know. Most people want to come to England, and you know, England's a place. But going back to the industry. Such a great pool of talent out there. And I think people now need to sort of utilize this time and think, okay, we're doing nothing now. So you may have a really good audio guy, that's sort of wondering what to do. You've probably got a really good video guy that's wondering what to do, and a really good musician that's wondering what to do. And I think it's at this time now where people start to put all these resources together and try to create something. So it's almost like saying, okay, nobody's doing any business now, the hospitality, car dealers, etc. So if I go and buy a bottle of bourbon, and I think, okay, I need something to drink it out of, I'll go and buy a glass. So I buy a bottle of bourbon, I go and buy a glass, and then I tell a friend, you know, hey, I'm having a drink. Oh, can I come round? Yeah, you need to go and buy a glass. And that snowballs then. So the glass person who's selling glasses, suddenly he's selling lots of glasses. Suddenly the guy selling bourbon is selling more bottles just because I've created a pool of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I think where this industry needs to go now, where people are sat there thinking, I'm not earning money, I'm not doing anything, I'm not doing this for free. And I think people now need to start looking at recreating something and utilize another person's skill, you know, utilizing a video guy and saying, hey, look, I'll do the audio for this.
Yeah.
Start creating.
Well,
I think more in the virtual world now.
And, you know, that is quite literally one of the through lines of this show. If you go back to episode one, season one, to now, Chris, is trying to explain to people that they need to learn as many aspects of their industry as possible and as many ways to flex that industry muscle in their everyday life and world around them as possible. Because when situations like this happen, I mean, even without this, even without the COVID crisis, we have known dead times in our industry. You know,
yes, we have.
Like, and it basically follows the school schedule. Like, and if you can think about it, think about how hard corporate executives work and things. They don't want to go on a week long conference in the middle of June when their kid's out on school break. You know,
yeah, I think when we got to 2008 with the credit crisis around the world, you know, saw a huge decline in the industry. Now, fortunately, it's built back up again. But I think now with this. Especially with large corporations, a lot of the corporations aren't going to survive this, and a lot of the organizations are not going to survive this. So I think we're probably going to lose maybe 30-40% of the clients at the moment of these organizations. I don't want to name any, obviously. So I think it's good for, you know, what we normally get is an audio guy. Hey, I'm not touching lighting. A lighting guy, I'm not touching audio. Fortunately for me, as you know, I can go into, yes, audio is my main background, but I can very easily jump on lighting. I can very easily jump on video.
Absolutely.
I can jump on LED. I've got that skill set to do pretty much everything.
That's just it. It's making yourself as available as possible on any job site to learn anything possible. I always find it funny because, as you know, as opposed to going into what we call GS or the big room, most of the time I'm in charge of the 20 or 30 ancillary rooms and setting up. And whenever I have people that come into my world and they want to be in the big world and GS and I don't know, I'm a lighting guy. And I'm like, you know how to plug a cable in? Well, yeah, good. If it doesn't fit, don't make it. Today you're going to learn how to set up projectors. Like, just consider it cross training. Now, like, now you can make money setting up projectors and lights. How about that? You know, like, the mentality to me doesn't translate because I want to know as much as possible. To me, it's a passion. I want to know as much about what's going on in my little world as I can.
I think it goes into when we were having a conversation away from this, when we were having a beer. I was talking about, you know, one of my hobbies is flying drones.
Mm.
We had this conversation.
Yeah.
And so with it just being a recreational hobby, I went on to get my commercial pilot's license for flying drones. And again, now I'm working, doing quite a lot of aerial photography and videography. So I'm doing some projects at the moment on farmland. Been a transferable skill, and people think, well, what is a drone got to do with the event industry? How, you know, how does that work? Well, it works the fact that the software that I actually put the films together with is the same software that we've been using in the event industry.
That's right.
So what I've learned in the event industry, I've transferred that skill to becoming a drone pilot. So yeah. Flying the drone, yes, is another skill, but the video production comes within this whole remit of what I've been doing for the last 35 years.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, it's been a durable skill.
And it really is the building upon a skill set that you already had, you know, you took a hobby, you took a skill set that you had and you married the two together.
Yeah.
And it really is that flexible thinking, that helps people get through these crises. It's that flexible thinking that brings about even new technologies in our industry. And it's great, you know, like right now I'm working on a Rode Procaster, and it's a great piece of machinery. But what I love about them is that they actually actively listen to engineers. And whenever we go, you know, it'd be cool is granular control over the compressor. Like instead of the compressor just being on or off, what if we could go in and set the ratio and threshold? That would be cool. And then they go in and add it. Because
I think that's something
we request it.
Missing in this industry. I find a lot of people in the industry of music and corporate, everybody's quite selfish in sharing information or sharing their knowledge.
Indeed.
You go on YouTube and you want to look something up, like, for example, videography and some great cinema effects with drones, and you can watch YouTube for days. If you go on there looking at trying to mix something or, you know, it's very limited, where a lot of engineers don't want to share that information. It's almost like, that's my secret.
Yeah.
And I think we need to open up a little bit more there and start helping people. So, you know, it would be good to have, you know, some good YouTube channels of, you know, this is how I do things, and the best way to get the best sound out of a drum kit is doing this. Yes, there are channels out there that do that.
Sure.
But I think there could be a lot more, and, you know, really, really sort of introduce people to this industry and show them what it's really about and how they can be successful in the industry, because as difficult as it is and the long days that we have, it's such a fun thing that we do. And
it
and you make some friends in this industry and you make friends for life.
Yeah. Yeah, no, most definitely. It is it's a great facet of the live events industry. It really is. It's something that whenever I moved to Austin, everybody that I'd worked with that were clients, club owners and bands, everything. Oh, man, what's the music scene like? It's like, I don't know. I do like 95% corporate AV now. I don't touch rock and roll. And I moved into the one of the harbing, like throbbing hearts of it.
Some of the events that I, you know, that I do worldwide on the corporate, I've worked on some amazing events, and some of the things, you know, and some of the speakers have been, some of the guest speakers, the keynote speakers have been absolutely outstanding, you know, and I just think I'm so privileged, and you know, also privileged to have, you know, some very confidential information of working with, you know, high-end people. High-end politicians, and I'm talking very, very high-end politicians, you know, world leaders, under closed doors, and you know, it's such a privilege to be involved in that, and you know, it's a lot of things that many people don't see, and you know, I'm so lucky, or am I lucky? I don't know. You know, did somebody knock on my door and say, "Hey, I think you make your own," you know, you do make your own luck.
Sure, sure, absolutely. You know. What through the years, Chris, from tinkering to moving on to professional touring rock and roll to and theater to moving into corporate AV, going to Dubai, doing events a few times a year, things like that. What has probably been the biggest thing that you have learned personally amongst all of that?
The biggest thing that I have learned is people skills. That's something I've learned so much, and I think that's come within in the later part of my life, of how to deal with people, how to understand people. Psychology is a big thing that I've learned, and that's been such a key part of my life, especially now in my older years. It's changed me into the person that I am now, and also my personal life. It's changed my personal life of how I go about my personal life and my the things that I do has pretty much all come from this industry. How I go about things on a day-to-day basis. It's although I could leave the industry tomorrow and think, okay, would I miss it? Yes, but I wouldn't be craving for it. If you understand, I've got so many other things to do in my life.
Yeah.
So many other interests in my life to do. But, I think I'll be doing this for many, many years to come, because I do enjoy it so much. And I enjoy the challenges. And it keeps me very young. It keeps me very active in my technical ability.
Yeah.
And I'm constantly learning every day. I'm studying every day something. From the minute I wake up, I'm studying something, whether it's something new in electronics, something new within the film industry.
Yeah, some new application of something that you use every day in your world. And, hey, wow, never really thought about using it like that, which we see regularly in our line.
I don't waste time. I read a lot in the daytime. I don't read books, but I'll read a lot on the internet. And, I love my politics. Just anything. I have to keep my brain active, and I have to keep that conversational thing going. So sometimes, people may not like what I'm very straight to the point, as and when we've been working together. I'm the friendliest man in the world. However, if somebody upsets me, I'm probably your worst enemy in the world.
You're gonna find out pretty quick.
I am the great British bulldog.
Yeah, the fact will not be hidden.
No. And one thing, as you know, we've been friends for a good while now. I don't suffer bullshit from people.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. And that's probably one of the biggest reasons why I personally love hanging out with you and working with you, is that I don't either. I just can't. I just can't.
It goes back in my early days. I think I mentioned when I was working with Holly, and there was Holly's went on stage, and in those days it was an intro tape. We put a tape in the tape. People listening are wondering, what's a tape? And so the band went on stage, and afterwards they said to me, "Hey, Chris, where was the intro this evening?" I said, "It was in my hotel room in my briefcase." And they just stood and looked at the Hollies and went, "Okay, that's a good, honest answer."
Yeah.
They were expecting me to say, "Hey, the tape machine crashed." Or,
Yeah. You know, give you some talk about like how wasn't ballasting outright, or some engineer speak.
Where was the tape? It was in my hotel room.
Yeah.
And I've always been like that. I always say it as it is. It's pointless making stories up, because you get found out.
Yeah. But
that's something that I've got a real talent for, is if somebody's lying to me, I can see it.
Yeah.
It's a talent.
And with that being said, Chris, what would be probably the one piece of advice you would give to anybody trying to come into this industry on any facet, live theater, rock and roll, pyrotechnics, whatever?
It's a question I get asked a lot, actually, because some of the posts on Facebook, not so much now, but I put posts on Facebook of where I was traveling to and the people that I was working with.
Yeah.
People say, "Hey, how do I get into this industry?" I'll say, they'll say, I've looked at a course at a college. I'll say, "You're wasting your time." No, I've worked with so many people that have come out of colleges and they've got a qualification for engineering or qualification for, being an artist. Just because you have a qualification for being a, an artist in painting doesn't mean to say you have the imagination. So I'd say anybody that wants to come into the industry is show a real valid interest and go and speak to the rental companies and show your interest. And like I used to do, and you probably used to do, we'd go out there and work for free because it was a passion. And then, you know, in those days, it wasn't a job. It was a passion. Yeah. And if you've got that passion, and then people see that passion, before you know it, you're earning, you know, $400 or $500 a day.
Yeah.
We'll see that. And it's worth that time of investing your free time to learn and learn and learn. One bit of advice I'd give to anybody that's coming in is listen to the old buggers. You know, because we've got, you know, I remember when I started off, I had a mentor who was about my age now, and I used to go around to his house and I'd listen to him. I'd never ever, you know, say, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I'd listen to him and I learned so much. Unfortunately now in this day and age, you know, as Oscar Wilde once said, I'm not young enough to know everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the advice I'd give is just, you know, show interest, go and talk to rental companies and say, could I come out on an event? I'll work for free. As long as you get fed, you know, and not sort of being subject to abuse of loading trucks and everything else.
Yeah.
Because I think that's just exploiting people and that's wrong. That's what I would say to anybody trying to get into the industry. And if they've got any talent, that talent will be picked up because there's always people out there looking for new talent. And I think for me especially, I'm constantly looking for, you know, new people. I've taken people on the road with me. For that exact reason, I said, hey, you know, you're great at this job. I'm going to put you as a backline tech. You know, and it's okay. So, you know, it's $100 a day. And they're like, really?
Yeah.
You know, I said, yeah, we're on the road for 20 days now. So that's going to be 2,000. And they're like, I've never earned that in 6 months. Well, there you go. You've had a talent there.
Yeah.
And then on tour with Queen or something like that, you know. That actually happened to a friend of mine, actually. He went on tour with Queen. He started as an audio guy. Then he went into video, and he was Queen's video guy.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. I mean, I bet my buddy Wes, my musical partner, he lives out in California now. He was an audio engineer that went on the road to work custom video rigs for the Marvel Universe, and ended up now he works in the warehouse for PRG. Maintaining projection and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it literally is one of those. And whenever he went to get the job originally, to go on the road and work with them, he was like, man, I don't know. Like, I don't know how to set up like a PDS 902, stuff like that. But I don't know how to like run a full video rig. And I was like, it's a custom rig. They are going to teach you how this thing is set up and how it's run. It's being built for this purpose. So don't be afraid. Go for it.
You know, when you look at the industry and, you know, when people think of corporate and they think, oh, it's just another conference, you know, I look at the corporate event I did 2 years ago, which we spoke about when I did the launch of the Macallan whiskey in Scotland.
Oh, yeah.
That was probably one of the biggest events that I've worked on in my life. And it was a real challenge to do what we did, to do the distillery launch. And it was a lot of money, very high profile guests, a serious amount of projection mapping. And it was another world. And still to this day, it's over 2 years ago now. And we still talk about that, of what an exciting event it was. And that was in Scotland. And It was a crazy time. That was me and Paddy, who you know, another from England, and we had such fun, and that led on to other things as well, you know. So everything just leads on to something else, and I don't think when people say, "Hey, you know, what's your resume?" and I have this leather wallet with all my tour passes from 1986.
Yeah.
Still keep them, regardless of what I work on. Even if it's just a shitty little conference, I'll keep the accreditation. And when I open them up and look at them periodically, And then it's when I remember who I worked with. So I don't keep a resume as such, but that is my resume.
Yeah.
And it used to be T-shirts, funnily enough. But then when I lived in Spain, I left my bag. I had a huge, big hold all full of all my tour T-shirts.
Oh,
probably fortunes now.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm getting ready to have all mine because I had to retire them. Like, I don't want to lose them. So here's the thought for all you folks out there that spent years working with bands and you just got T-shirts out the wazoo that don't fit you, but you don't want to get rid of because of the sentimentality. Find yourself somebody local that sews and have those cool rock and roll T-shirts turned into a quilt. It's the coolest idea in the world. It's literally your career on a quilt. It's so awesome.
I always said, I'd like to open, maybe in about 10 years' time, I want to open a steakhouse. And, as I said earlier, you know, my love for the United States and the food in the United States. And that's something we really miss in England, you know. And every time I come back to England, I come back here kicking and screaming. And then I go to a restaurant or a bar, and it's just the service just doesn't exist here like it does in the US. So I always said I'd like to open a store here that has that proper service, the food like it is in the States, then have some of my memorabilia around the walls.
Right.
So it's sort of a rock of ages.
That'd be awesome.
It's sort of living the dream, that, you know, whether I actually follow it through, I don't know. But it's something that I would like to do one day.
Absolutely.
And maybe have a corner of somebody playing piano and saxophone or something, but you know, that's for a later time.
Well, and you know, Chris, thank you so much. I'm so glad that we connected and had a chance to finally make this episode happen, because to hear someone like you who has been through the ropes of the game from the beginning to now, and to have moved on in your career the way that you have, to be able to give the advice that you've given unabridgedly and unabashedly to our audience is so fantastic.
I started at the bottom and I like it there.
Yeah. And you know, it really is. It's one of those industries that you either love it or you hate it. It's not for everybody, but for those it's for, it is utter passion. Every day, even if I wasn't out on the road, and you can ask my wife, folks, I have not been on the road for a few months now. My studio has been rewired I'm literally in the middle of building another patch bay right now, because I can't not wire things. I can't, like, it's just instinctive. It's like a bird building a nest. If you keep throwing twigs out, it's going to keep building.
Exactly.
I can't not do it. So
I've been playing drones all day, just going through my firmwares, my drones, you know, keeping what I do. But you know, if any of the listeners out there, you know, want any advice, or they want to drop a line through and, you know, want to ask me any questions, you know, they can feel free. You know, I'm sure there's a channel they can come through to conduit, just to open up if anybody wants any help, or, you know, just an informal chat. I'm out there to help anybody, you know. And some of my secrets I can give away, some of my secrets I can't, because that's the Masonic world, but
that's another podcast and another episode in and of itself. Chris, thank you once again so much for taking the time out of your schedule to come on to chat. Tell everybody where they can go to get a hold of you if they want drone work done, stuff like that.
Yeah, I'll get a link over to you to drop in. But I have a Facebook page called Aerial Picks.
All right, there you go. Hop onto Facebook, follow his page, check him out. Chris, once again, thank you so much. Please do hold the line while we close things out. While you're online following Chris, checking things out on his Aerial Picks Facebook page, stop on by Talking Sound Podcast. That is where you can get all of the episodes. That's where you can find the freelance directory, where you can find companies that hire freelance AB technicians. That is where you can find industry news, all kinds of great stuff. Make sure to stop on by HC Universal Network. That is our parent network, where you can check out all of the episodes and so much more from other great shows. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of your hearing, and keep reaching for 11. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.